Chapter 7. His Last Attack. I want to remind you that our story does have descriptions of violent crimes and sexual assaults. It may not be suitable for some listeners. Sherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez are murdered on July 27, 1981. Their murders won't officially be connected to the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker series until 2001. But in hindsight, the details of the attack reveal volumes about the killer and may explain why 5 years go by before he attacks again.
So on July 27, 1981, Gregory Sanchez drops by Sherry Domingo's house in Goleta, California. So in this attack, it appears that the offender enters in through the south gate and notices a pile of wood stakes. He grabs that wood stake and then goes around the rear perimeter of the house to the north side of the house where the master bedroom is at. This is an unusual house in that the master bathroom has a door that leads out to the side of the house where now the offender is standing there with a wood stake. He sees this garden shed and opens that garden shed up and finds two better weapons. It appears there's a pipe wrench and a tool similar to a nail puller inside this garden shed. At this point, he breaks into the house. It appears that Gregory Sanchez hears something, gets up, possibly grabs a flashlight, and then ends up facing where the sound is, which is coming from the master bathroom. The offender comes into the room from the master bathroom and is now standing at a distance, but face to face with 6'3" Gregory Sanchez. The offender, armed with a gun, shoots Gregory Sanchez. The bullet enters Gregory Sanchez's left cheek and exits out behind his left ear. However, it's a non-fatal wound, but it most certainly would be a stunning blow, would cause Gregory Sanchez to potentially lose consciousness. Gregory Sanchez drops down onto the floor, and at this point, the offender is now able to go and go hands-on with Sherry Domingo on the bed. And he gets her hands bound behind her back, and it appears that there is, at some point during this attack, some sexual activity, because he does leave his DNA behind in this case. Gregory Sanchez becomes alert again. He reanimates, and now the offender has to go and get hands-on with Gregory Sanchez. He gets into a physical fight with this 6'3" male, a physically bigger male than what the offender is. We see blows being inflicted to Gregory Sanchez's face, like from a fist, and then Gregory Sanchez ultimately has multiple blows from a thin weapon to the back of his head. The blood staining that is present within the closet where this battle appears to have flowed into tends to suggest that Gregory Sanchez possibly laid motionless multiple times during the course of this activity, possibly with the offender leaving him and having to come back when he's noticing that Sanchez is still alive and having to inflict more blows. Ultimately, Sanchez doesn't move again. Though Gregory Sanchez put up quite a struggle with the offender, he ultimately lost. He is found laying face down with his head in the closet, and a pile of clothes had been pulled off the closet rod and dumped on top of him. Once Gregory Sanchez had been bludgeoned to death, the killer goes over, bludgeons Sherry Domingo on the bed, and then leaves the house. I believe the killer could have been hurt during this attack. He most certainly was scared, and he left that crime scene thinking, I could have been caught, I could have been killed, I don't want either to occur. When the East Area Rapist moved down to Southern California in 1979, Southern California authorities had no idea who the East Area Rapist was. All of a sudden, they had somebody who was breaking into houses in the middle of the night and typically bludgeoning his victims to death. They actually start calling him the Night Stalker. Now, today, everybody thinks of Richard Ramirez when they hear the term Night Stalker. Well, that's because the media, when they started following Richard Ramirez, called him the Night Stalker.
Richard Ramirez was a serial killer and rapist who killed at least 14 people in the Los Angeles and San Francisco areas. He was captured in 1985.
At this point, Orange County, Santa Barbara, and Ventura authorities have to come up and rename their offender. I believe it was law enforcement or the media that came up with the term original Night Stalker. Actually, it might even have been Larry Poole.
My name is Larry Poole, P-O-O-L. I just merely referred to him as the original Night Stalker, and the media, when they picked up on that, that name kind of stuck. I was the case agent for the original Night Stalker investigation for the Orange County Sheriff's Department from 1997 through 2013.
Typically, it's the media that likes to give serial killers a catchy name.
As crass as it may sound, some level of marketing does benefit a case. You're seeking the community's assistance. When you refer to a moniker such as that, they immediately know who you're speaking about.
For 5 years, the original Night Stalker goes quiet. No murders or rapes are reported that match his MO. And to date, no other cases during this period have been linked to him by DNA. Some investigators think it's possible he could be responsible for other murders and rapes at the time. But until they have that evidence in hand, it's all just speculation.
Okay, so now we're going to head to Encina Drive in Irvine, where Janelle Cruz was killed in May 1986. It's about 2 miles northeast from the location where he killed Manuela Huitun in 1981. This is it right here. That's where Janelle Cruz's house is. So now we're standing at the park that is behind Janelle Cruz's former house. Early investigators, as they were assessing the crime scene locations, thought they noticed a pattern that the offender was purposefully attacking houses that were near open spaces. So they thought that he possibly was using a park like this in order to prowl and be able to gain access to the rear yards of houses.
My name is Michelle Cruz, and I'm the sister of Janelle Cruz, the last known victim of the Golden State Killer. In March 1986, I decided to go to Mammoth Mountain with a bunch of my friends and my boyfriend. My parents didn't want me to. I was a senior in high school, and everybody was going. People that had already graduated from school, they were all going up to the mountain to work on the mountain because it was a really good snow season. And my boyfriend was going, so I'm like, I want to go. My mom and my stepfather were separated, and they were in the process of possibly getting back together again. My stepfather was going on vacation to Cancun, and he was taking my little brother. And my mom did not want him to take my little brother to Cancun without her. And so they decided that she would go as well. It was a last-minute thing.
This leaves 19-year-old Janelle Cruz alone at her family's home on the night of the attack.
Janelle and I had a very close bond. We did everything together. We had the same group of friends. However, Janelle was more outgoing when it came to meeting different people. She was very charismatic, and I would say the guys just kind of flocked towards her. She only had a few close girlfriends. But Janelle and I were like best friends. We fought like sisters. We got in some pretty good fights. But if it came down to it, she would be the first one to protect me from a bully. She also protected me from our stepfather. We had an abusive stepfather. There was one time that I remember where Janelle needed to kind of step in and take the beating from our stepfather. We were just kids. We were, I don't know, maybe 12, 13, 14 years old, and you know, we had to be home at 5 o'clock, so we rode our bikes home, and we knew, gosh, we better hurry up before 5 o'clock hits or we're gonna get in trouble. So we rushed and rushed and rushed. We finally got home, and our stepdad was outside, and he had a belt, and he was pulling the belt, making a slapping noise, and we're like, oh boy, we're gonna get in trouble. And so we were about just a couple minutes past five, maybe 5:05. Janelle walked in, and she got beat up for that. He pushed her around. There was another incident where I can remember a boy coming over, knocking on the door, and our stepdad opened the door, and this boy said, "Is Janelle there?" We were in maybe fifth and sixth grade at the time. Well, the boy was a black boy, and my stepfather slammed the door and took Janelle into the other room, into his bedroom, and I can hear Janelle screaming and him throwing her up against a wall and pushing her, and I don't know what he was doing in there, but You know, she was crying and screaming, and my mom and I sat in another bedroom just listening to it. We couldn't do anything. I don't know why my mom didn't step up. She would say because he was just very controlling. Janelle was 5'1" with an hourglass figure. She was short, but she had a really skinny waist and big hips and long brown hair, and she'd parted on the side. Didn't wear a lot of makeup, just maybe some eyeliner, and she looked very natural. And we have Puerto Rican in us, so we had a Spanish look to us. And she had light brown hair, hazel brown eyes. She was natural pretty and soft-spoken. The guys loved her. She just had a charismatic personality. There was a time where she cut her hair really short because she was tired of guys looking at her and trying to get together with her. So she cut it short so that she wouldn't be as cute to them. That didn't work. They still liked her. Janelle went on dates. She didn't really have any steady boyfriends. She just had a lot of friends. But these friends really liked her. They were in love with her, but they were just friends. She would hang out with them, go to the beach, go to their house. They'd drive her around. To her, these were just good friends. But to the guys, they probably felt like there was more than that. But she did not have a boyfriend at the time. Janelle and I actually talked about having a double wedding. So we'd get married and we'd have our kids and we'd be neighbors and we'd raise our kids together. Yeah, we thought about all those things. May 4th, 1986, my parents left for Cancun with my younger brother and Janelle had a friend over. They had heard noises by the window. Janelle looked out and didn't see anything, and she disregarded it as maybe a cat. And so they just continued on listening to music, talking, and Janelle was showing him some poetry. At around 10:45, he said he had to leave because he had his mother's car, and so he had to take the car back to his mom and go back home. And from 11 o'clock to 12, I don't know if that was the moment she was brutally raped and murdered, but I do know that a friend called her around midnight and she did not pick up the phone. I don't know if she had been killed just before or if she was struggling at midnight trying to stay alive. One way or the other, that's when Janelle was killed.
My name is Larry Montgomery. I worked for the Irvine Police Department. We discovered it on May 5th of 1986, late in the afternoon. The home was for sale, so there were realtors that were sometimes coming by with potential buyers to open the lockbox and go inside and take a look. And I think it was near close to 5 o'clock in the afternoon when a realtor arrived with some potential buyers. They entered the house through the lockbox in the front door, and they were the ones that actually discovered the crime when they entered Janelle Cruz's room. She was found dead on the bed, and they called the police. I went directly to the scene, along with several other investigators. When we arrived at Janelle's home, we saw that there was a back sliding glass door that was opened about a foot. There was a carton of milk that was on a table near the refrigerator that was partially full of milk. Janelle was in her bedroom, which was down around a corner away from the kitchen a ways. And she was on her bed. She was on her back. She had blankets covering her face. And she had been bludgeoned fairly severely. It looked very much like she may have been tied up. And then the ties were taken. And she was left in that position. She was very bloody. When the lab people got there, they said that there were tufts of material on her. And I asked the lab, what is that? I saw it. They were able to describe that. If you take a cloth and you rip it, then the little stuff which is falls from that would be tufts of basically the threads. Gravity takes it down to wherever it stops. In this case, it was on her body. Her hands were in a position that looked like they were tied, but there was no ligature marks on it. Ropes usually make a ligature mark. However, ties, like if they are made from soft ligatures, they wouldn't make a imprint.
So at that time, Janelle and I, we shared a bedroom. We had the white shutters and a white dresser. And on the dresser, Janelle would put up, you know, a jewelry box and hang her jewelry, things like that. And then we had our closet. It was a mirrored closet that we could open, you know, back and forth.
How Janelle Cruz's body was positioned on the bed was interesting. Her head is towards the foot of the bed. In Janelle's room, her closet had those mirrored doors. I believe that as the offender is on top of Janelle and he's sexually assaulting her and then ultimately bludgeoning her, he's able to watch himself do that in that closet mirror.
Janelle's family said that there was a pipe wrench next to the back door that they remembered being there when they went on their vacation, and it wasn't there, and we never found it. That may be the weapon used by the killer. The back slider was opened. It wasn't forced open. It was opened when the people came with the realtor. So it's very possible the suspect came through that unlocked slider, took the tool with him, and used that tool to kill Janelle.
At some point that day, news reaches Michelle up at Mammoth Mountain.
I was working on the mountain, and my shift was over, and it was a major, major snowstorm. A lot of snow. I made it across the street after getting off, and I went to my dorms, and I changed, and I can remember going to this area where all the people who worked on the mountain would go and play pool. So we were all over there, and someone came and got me and said, "You got a phone call." So I walked over to the phone, held it up to my ear. I said, "Hello." And it was my friend on the other end, a good friend. And she's like, "Michelle." And I said, "Yes." And she's like, "Are you sitting down?" And I'm like, "No." And she's like, "You need to sit down." And I'm like, "Okay." I'm like, "What's going on?" And she said, "Your sister was murdered." And I said, "My sister got married." And she said, "No, your sister was murdered." And from that point on, I do not remember hanging up that phone call. Things changed a lot at that moment. Pretty much my entire identity changed. I don't remember anything except for I was snowed in and I wanted to get home. And I couldn't get home because my boyfriend, his car was under the snow and the snow was just piled over the car. So I couldn't get out. We were snowed in. For 2 days, I waited to get out of there. I can remember my boyfriend shoveling it out and me trying to help. And it was just too difficult. We needed to let it melt because it was a lot of ice. I was stranded. I was stuck. And I remember sitting on the stairs of the dorms and people would walk by me. "Are you okay?" And I said, "Well, my sister just got murdered." And they were like, "What?" And nobody really wanted to talk to me. I guess they just didn't know what to say. So I was kind of by myself, just sitting there, just hoping to get home as soon as possible. I can remember going down the mountain and it was very icy. The roads were very dangerous, so we were going slow down, you know, through the mountain until we got out of all that cold. And then after that, it was like a very steady pace. We got home pretty quickly from Mammoth to Irvine. But it was a very quiet drive. We didn't say much.
Two suspects came to light. The first one, as I was talking to the neighbors across the street after we were dispatched out to the call, my sergeant in the investigation saw a car drive up with a young 17-year-old male who came down to where the tape was across the road and was making a U-turn. He looked extremely nervous. So the sergeant stopped him and talked to him and found he was sweating and he was shaking. He asked for his ID and found out he didn't have a real good reason for being down there and got his ID and let him go. Brought it to me and said, "You need to get a hold of this guy because something's fishy about this kid."
That night before her body was found, Janelle Cruz had dropped by the place where she works, a pizza place called Bullwinkle's. And I've wondered, was the killer a customer there and had seen this beautiful girl and decided, "I'm going to follow her home and see if she could potentially be a victim"?
Later on, they gave us information at Bullwinkle's that she was with a young guy that night and she left around 7 o'clock with that guy. He had been there for an hour or so, kind of hanging out while she was finishing her shift and talking to her. They thought they could recognize him if they saw him again. They did see him again, actually, the next morning at a little after 10 o'clock. Janelle's shift started at 10 the next morning, and he came in a little after 10 that morning and asked if Janelle was there. And they said, "No, she didn't come to work." and he left. So we found pictures of this kid and showed it to the people at the store. And they said, yeah, that's the kid that left with her the night before. So he became a great interest to us. We contacted him and he said that, yeah, he was there that day with Janelle at the pizza parlor. And yeah, they walked out about the same time, but they didn't leave together. And then he went home and he knew her. And when we confronted him about coming the next day, he did admit that he came in to look for her, but she wasn't there. And he said, I never went to her house ever. He doesn't know where she lived. So that seemed a little odd. We did surveillances on him. We gave him information that maybe the weapon was found, because we thought if he had done this crime, that he may have taken the weapon with him and may have ditched it in a creek nearby. We could watch him and see if he goes to a creek and pulls the weapon out or something. He did not go anywhere to look for anything like that, but he went to an attorney. He came in with his attorney a day or so later, and he admitted to us something he hadn't admitted originally. He said that he lied to us before. He had left with Janelle, and he did go to her house, and he knew where she lived, and he went into her house the night before she was found dead. And they were together in her bedroom, and they listened to some music. And at one point, at 11 o'clock at night, they heard some noise that was coming from the side yard. She even went to the window and looked and didn't see anything. He just remembers they thought maybe it's a cat or something. And then he said, shortly after that, I left. He said, I lied to you because I was scared. He did admit to going back the next day and looking for her at Bullwinkle's restaurant. If he killed her, why would he go to work and ask if she's there? If he killed her, why does he have to drive by in his car and look like he's death warmed over and shaking in his boots in front of a police sergeant? And so he was off our radar because of his actions. They were not consistent with a guilty person, consistent with a lying person, but not a guilty person. But months after that is when we got our second lead that was even more powerful.
Even at that time, I thought it's still got to be someone she knew. I always thought it has to be somebody she knew, somebody, maybe even it was just an acquaintance.
And that happened when a young man called us to say that a friend of his, Greg, had told this informant that he had killed Janelle.
When Janelle was 15 or 16, she was rebelling a little bit. You know, our stepfather was not good to us, and she started cutting herself and drinking and just doing things that weren't good. And she had reached out to my mom and asked my mom to get her some help. So my mom let her go to a hospital. And when she was in that hospital, she met Greg Gonzalez. And eventually she got out of the hospital, but she stayed in contact with Greg Gonzalez. And he was sort of a guy we all knew. Some of his friends were our friends also, and his cousins, we knew his cousins. And Greg was in a van with some of my friends after Janelle was killed and said that he had killed Janelle.
Obviously, we were very interested in, okay, who is this guy? And he tells this informant that he killed her. And he also made a statement that he had tried a similar thing, kind of like a prelude to it, to another girl he knew a couple days earlier in Santa Ana. So we discover that this guy had, in fact, been arrested by Santa Ana Police Department a couple days earlier. And so we get the reports regarding that arrest. And it was involving a girl that also knew this guy named Greg from rehab. She invited him into her apartment in Santa Ana a couple days before Janelle was killed. And during the time they were in the room together, there was a point where he kind of changed his attitude. Greg went over to her kitchen and got a dish towel, and he started to rip strips off the dish towel and acting really strange. And she got really scared, and she ended up actually going to a window she's on the second floor and jumping out of a window, which would be kind of dangerous, but she thought he was going to tie her up or something. And she jumped out and screamed, and the police are called, and he's caught at the scene. And he's arrested, and he spent a night in jail before he was released on bail. And 2 days later, we're looking at our crime scene with a girl who's bludgeoned to death and she's got tufts of material on her from something that would happen if you ripped some material in order to make strips to tie you up. We ended up getting him in custody. He wouldn't talk to us or did not admit to anything. We had him in custody for months. We don't have something that says he did this, guaranteed by physical evidence. We couldn't find his hair there. We couldn't find anything on his clothing that matched any blood. Didn't find any evidence from the crime scene or on his clothes or on his bicycle that he would have had to have probably ridden over. So he was released from custody because if we went to trial, he probably would be found not guilty just because you couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right after Janelle was killed, we were living in a hotel because we didn't go back home. We never went back in that house. We moved back east, and maybe a month later, 2 months later, I had just turned 18, and I told my mom I wanted to move back to California. So I moved back to California on my own. My mom and my little brother stayed in New Jersey. The realtor, the broker who had our house listed, he gave me a job as a receptionist. I rented a room and paid my car payment and just did my own thing. And then the house sold. My mom said, "Well, you just go in there and make sure everything's out of the house for, you know, the new owner." And I can remember going over to the house and having to walk in, and it was really dark, and it was really cold, and it was just a really eerie feeling. It was the strangest feeling I had ever felt. Really just wanted to get in there and get out of there as quick as possible. But I walked through the house quickly. I looked in my room, and everything was clean. I didn't see any evidence of Janelle being killed in there. I never got any of my things out of my room. They were just gone. Everything was completely gone. I had the clothes in my bag, and that was it. There was one time that I drove to the house, and I saw the mattress laying outside and the box spring on our grass. And I just couldn't believe my eyes because it was just filled with blood from the top of the mattress, and it had sunk through all the way down to the bottom to the box spring. And it was a lot of blood, and I couldn't believe that that mattress was put on our grass and nobody was there at that moment to take it away. I just happened to have driven by that house at that time and saw it there.
Janelle Cruz is the last known victim of the Golden State Killer. As the years and decades go by, the same question keeps nagging at us. Why did he stop?
So after Janelle Cruz is killed in 1986, that's the last attack that we know this offender has done. Got to wonder, why does he stop at this point? He's been offending since 1976 for 10 years. He's getting older. It's possible he's realizing his physical skills are diminishing. When I take a look at other offenders, the one that stands out to me as being the most similar to the Golden State Killer is BTK, Dennis Rader. And when Dennis Rader was caught and when he was interviewed, he talked about in his last attack, he got into a physical fight with a male that he was not expecting to be present inside that house. And even though he won that battle, he left that house scared. And I think the same type of thing possibly is happening with the Golden State Killer.
Sometimes serial killers stop because they're getting older or because they've gone through a major change in their lives, such as getting married or having kids. But in this case, it could also be out of fear of DNA science.
I've also looked at whether or not he was concerned about the evidence he'd left behind.
This was in 1986. I think that was the year actually when people started talking about the possibility of DNA.
In the late 1980s, DNA starts coming into the headlines in criminal cases. However, the public really didn't become aware of DNA technology until the O.J. Simpson case in 1995. And that's when the public is learning all about DNA testing and what it means. The Golden State Killer has to be watching the O.J. trial, and he's thinking, uh-oh, I've left my DNA everywhere. Even though he did everything else he possibly could, he hid his face. He prevented leaving fingerprints behind. He disguised his voice. He did all that verbal staging. He's now recognizing that this DNA technology could catch him.